May it please the court.
May proceed.
Mr. Smith. This attorney discipline case is about a lot of things. However, it is not a First Amendment freedom of speech case. The case is all about misconduct. Misconduct involving threats, intimidation, and ultimately false condemnation directed at citizens who would dare to write character reference letters contradicting the respondent's position. It's particularly troublesome when the misconduct is carried out by a public official, a prosecutor who under our rules of professional conduct is charged with the duty to serve as a minister of justice. Informant understands respondent's attempt to frame his misconduct in terms of freedom of speech, to cloak himself in constitutional protections. It's the only way he can even try to justify and rationalize his bullying tactics directed at innocent citizens who refuse to capitulate to his threats and demands.
If the press release had been issued without any of the prior discussions, would your allegations be the same?
If the prosecuting attorney
had just issued the press release, had the hearing, subpoenaed the individual, subpoenaed, cross-examined him, they said whatever they were going to say, but there was no discussion with those folks before he issued the press release, would your position be the same?
If he had not had them in beforehand, threatened them with the press release.
Either subpoenaed them or not, but just issued the press release.
Okay, he issues the press release. It's a factual press release. It doesn't contain the statement that they appear to support the child molester over the victim.
I'm talking about if he issued the exact press release without any prior discussions with them.
If he issued a factual press release and either attached the letters or told the press where they could get the letters, we wouldn't be here today.
But that's not the question. The question is, pretend none of the early stuff happened. You just had the press release. As it is. I think that's what the Chief Justice is asking.
I think it violates 4-4.4a and 8.4d to issue that press release regardless of the prior contact. The press release was false. If you look at the letters that Mr. Haig and the Nash has sent in, the letters do not state a disbelief in the victim. The letters do not question that Payton committed the crime. They do not state any support for pedophilia or child molestation. Mr. Haig doesn't mention or reference any reduced sentence for Payton. He doesn't reference the fact that he was a prior president of Platte Valley Bank or imply that he was writing as a representative of the bank. Ms. Nash doesn't reference the fact that she was a former county collector, and Mr. Nash doesn't reference the fact that he owned Nash Gas, a local business. They are benign in content. However, to then issue the press release in which he basically says that they are supporting a child molester over the victim that he repeatedly abused, to me, is a false statement, given those letters, the benign nature of the letters, and secondly, is simply issued to embarrass these letter writers. Now, if you want to separate the fact that he had these prior conversations, that's fine. Standing alone, that press release, I think, violates the rules.
But the letters were in a public file, true?
Absolutely, Judge Russell. The letters were there. They could have been attached to the press release. He could have said, here's the case number, go get them.
Well, the fact that he publicized the existence of them was already public.
But it's the mischaracterization, the sinister mischaracterization of these benign letters into a support of pedophilia and child molestation that, in my view, violated the rules, held these letter writers up to ridicule by the public, which they were ridiculed by the public, and violated the rules. It's not that he references the letters, it's that it was a false representation of what those letters, the substance of those letters, Judge Russell. They were letters that were written in a benign fashion at the request of Payton's father, and he could have attached them, he could have told the press or anyone else, the public, where to go look at them. But once he starts recharacterizing them and misstating the content of those letters, I think he's using means that are intended to burden and embarrass the third parties, the Nashes and Mr. Haig, and he's engaging in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice.
Mr. Zahn's brief characterizes the request for the letters as coming from Mr. O'Connor, and you've just stated that it came from Mr. Padden's father. Was there evidence in the record that Mr. O'Connor contacted any of the letter writers to solicit?
I think what happened was Payton's father contacted O'Connor and said, would the letters help? He said, sure, if you want to go ahead and have people write letters, go ahead. He did not contact the letter writers. O'Connor did not. And in fact, they have instructions that those letters should be sent directly to Judge Van Amberg with copies sent to Mr. Zahn and to himself. He did not make those requests.
In addition to not making the initial request, did he consult with them? Does the record show he consulted with them or had any contact with them?
I don't believe so, Judge Breckenridge. In fact, I think his testimony was he didn't think it would do any good. Given the crime committed, he didn't think those letters would do any good. Nevertheless, Peyton's father asked about them, and so he said, go ahead and send them. But he did not have contact, to my knowledge, with any of the letter writers before those letters were sent in. The violation here is Rule 4-4.4A, and it involves both having them into the office prior to the hearing on the sentencing, as well as the press release itself. 4-4.4A is intended to deter just the type of bullying tactics the respondent used in this case. And courts have applied an objective standard in making that determination. What would a normal, reasonable attorney have done under the same or similar circumstances? Not what this specific attorney's subjective standard was. It's abundantly clear, given that standard, that the respondent's only substantial purpose in contacting Mr. Haig and the Nashes prior to sentencing was to force them to withdraw their letters by way of threat and intimidation. And then it's also abundantly clear that the substantial purpose in the October 30 press release was to burden and embarrass them with false characterizations in an attempt to punish these citizens for failing to abide by his demands and threats.
Could you clarify that for me?
Sure, I hope.
I thought you said that we look at them with an objective standard.
Correct,
but,
Judge.
But you're looking at them with a subjective. If you look at the letters, there might have been some purpose to them. You're arguing that subjectively he had no purpose. So is it an objective review? If I just look at the language, I can come up with reasons one might do, which Mr. Zahn's argued in his brief, or is it that we look at what was his subjective motive in doing it?
I think what we look at is, number one, would a reasonable attorney and prosecuting attorney in the same or similar circumstances have done what this respondent did? And I think the answer to that is no. A reasonable prosecutor in the same or similar circumstances would not have threatened and intimidated prior to sentencing and would not have sent a false press release after sentencing mischaracterizing these benign letters as supporting pedophilia and child molestation.
Where does his intent come in then? The state of mind, which
is
always relevant.
Intent comes in. The panel found that it was intentional. That he did this for the purpose of embarrassing them, to hold them up to public ridicule.
And is that clearly relevant to sanction? Were we to find that? Is that also relevant to a violation? Or
I think it's relevant in terms of sanction, for sure. In violation would be, would a reasonable attorney have done this? Would a reasonable prosecuting attorney have issued this press release? Would you have had these people in before sentencing and threatened them? And I think the answer to that is we apply a reasonable attorney standard, and the answer to that is no.
Opposing counsel says his purpose was to inform them of the facts of the case because they might not have been aware of them when they offered the letters.
Well, he did much more than that. He threatened them. He said, withdraw this letter or I'm going to issue a press release stating that you're in support of child molestation. He may have had another purpose in doing it, but let me say this. The case law uniformly has found that if you have both a legitimate and illegitimate purpose in your actions, the means under 4.4A, it's a violation of the rule. Courts across the country, most prominently in Kansas, have found that when you have both a legitimate and an illegitimate purpose for your actions, it's a violation of 4.4A. And I would point the court to the Campbell case, where a prosecutor was suspended for 6 months for showing photographs to parents of children who attended a party, underage children, where they drank, had sexual intercourse, and the court found there was a legitimate purpose, as stated by the prosecutor, to decrease and deter underage drinking. It also found an illegitimate purpose to embarrass and burden the parents and children who engaged in that conduct. They found the violation notwithstanding legitimate purposes and suspended that prosecutor for 6 months. There are a number of other cases cited at pages 40 to 42 of our brief where courts have also found illegitimate and legitimate purposes as being a violation of the rule. There's no doubt that both of these rules go to conduct, not free speech, not speech. They cite to the Gentile case. Gentile v. State Bar of Nevada involved Nevada's Ethics Rule 177, which is identical to our Rule 4-3.6, the trial publicity rule. And basically what it says is it prohibits a lawyer from making extrajudicial statements that will be disseminated by public means and that are likely to materially prejudice an adjudicative proceeding. The court found the violation there, but they also, that rule explicitly impacted and restricted lawyer speech. The rules at issue here explicitly, at least in terms of 8.4D, go to conduct. And I would argue that 4.4A also goes to conduct based on the Kriegel decision issued by this court in 2016.
Did he make the comments that he made and make the press release that he made in his capacity as prosecutor as opposed to in his individual personal capacity?
I don't think there's any doubt that he was serving as a prosecutor. He himself says he's trying to educate the public and let them know that these so-called prominent citizens of Dearborn were engaging in this activity. You know, the fact is, Judge Stith, if he had a problem with those letters, he could have used proper judicial means to attack them. He could have filed a motion to strike those letters. They were simply sent in by these people. He could have filed a motion to strike. He could have brought them into the hearing and cross-examined these people, and at least then it would have been under the watchful eye of Judge Van Amberg and subject to objection by Mr. O'Connor. Instead, he goes outside the judicial process, attacks these people in his press release, and clearly holds them up to ridicule by the public in violation of the rules that we cite.
Does the record support that, in fact, he consented to consideration of the letters by the sentencing court?
I'm sorry, Judge Breckenridge?
Did he consent to the sentencing judge considering the letters? That's in the respondent's brief.
I think that in the end, they were before the court. Judge Van Amberg, I believe, testified that they had no effect on him. But nevertheless, I think they ended up in the court record.
Did the prosecutor, though, say, we have no objection and consent to Judge Van Amberg considering the letters?
I believe that may very well be the case, that they did that. Nevertheless, immediately after the sentencing, after this guy gets sentenced to two 25-year consecutive sentences for this 52-year-old Payton, after all that's done, he issues a press release attacking Mr. Haig and the Nashes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and happy May Day. May it please the court. Your Honors, I'm here representing Mr. Eric Zahn, who's been the prosecuting attorney of Platte County, Missouri for 15 years, and he's also my lifelong friend. I'm proud to be here today to represent him. This case isn't like your usual disciplinary case where everybody knows it's wrong to steal from a client, and the question is, did you steal from the client? Rather, this case is about what do these rules allow and what do they prohibit? And, of course, the touchstone is what a reasonable attorney can infer by reading the rules and saying, can I comply with that if I do this? And I don't think anybody, although I think the OCDC has tried to strip a lot of the context of this case out about why Mr. Zahn did the things he did because he had a valid purpose for doing so. It's more like that suddenly Mr. Zahn, this well-respected prosecuting attorney, became a rogue prosecutor, that he either didn't choose to read the rules, which that's not his character, or that he read the rules and he truly believed that the notice that those rules provided, that he was well within his rights to do everything he did, that the rules either provided for it, or the First Amendment guaranteed him his right to do that, or that he was in the safe harbor of Rule 4-3.6. So, having said that, the OCDC has raised several violations. And, of course, there's alleged violation of Rule 4.4-4A, and although today here that particular rule violation, which the rule just says that there has to be a substantial purpose other than embarrassing or burdening somebody, in this case the letter writers, They now want to argue, the OCDC now wants to argue, that that not only applies to the press release, but it also applies to the discussions that he had with the letter writers. I urge the court to go look at the record, at the charging document, at the arguments made in front of the panel, and see if the OCDC ever argued the threat was a violation of this rule. In fact, the threat, the discussion that Mr. Zahn and his assistants had with the letter writers, they charged that under 4-8.4D, claiming that Mr. Zahn was trying to threaten and intimidate these letter writers. And in fact, they even alleged that it was a violation of the Sixth Amendment. But of course, later they had fully admitted there is no Sixth Amendment right to have letter writers ex parte influence a judge in a sentencing, a criminal matter. In fact, I believe it was Judge Wilson in the Einstein case that said, there is no law providing for this ex parte influencing a judge in a criminal sentencing. So it might be beneficial, if nothing else in this case, if the court lays down some pretty specific guidelines about how this process is to occur.
As I understand it, the letters were filed with the court and copies were provided to both parties. Help me understand why that's an ex parte communication.
Indeed. First of all, any letter, and that is a letter, because at that point in time when the letter was given to the court, there was no opportunity to cross-examine them about their knowledge of this case. And again, as Judge Wilson pointed out, these letters are pretty much worthless unless it goes to the heart of the case. In other words, these people have special information that will be beneficial to the court.
Why would that be any different than an affidavit that's attached to a motion?
Well, in this case, that isn't the process. In other words, they didn't attach an affidavit and follow a set process. In fact, I'd like to point out to the court that the process that was supposed to be followed in Platt County that had always been followed is that you file your letter with the prosecuting attorney first, and that makes perfect sense. Because once that letter goes to the judge and he reads it, by the time the prosecutor can raise any objections, the bell is rung.
Well, we assume that judges hear inadmissible evidence all the time, and we rely on them to only, the case after case says that we rely on judges to only take into account properly admitted evidence. So the fact the judge may read them does not indicate the judge considered if they were improper.
And I didn't mean to indicate that at all, Judge, and I think what you said is exactly accurate. What I'm trying to set up is the context with which Mr. Zahn was faced, what he had to do.
When you do it, you said what you do is object. Why didn't you do what OCDC says should have been done if he thought letters were inappropriate and file a motion to strike?
All right. What Mr. Zahn saw, and again, I realize that Monday morning quarterbacking is things you have to do in disciplinary action, so I'm not condemning Monday morning quarterbacking. But here's the situation Mr. Zahn was faced with, and here's what he considered. Mr. Zahn thought, okay, what I can do is I'll just subpoena him, I'll take him into court, I'll put him under oath, and I'll ask all the same questions and get all the information in open court. The press will be there because this was a high-profile case, and the press will report all this. But he thought to himself, look, if I were one of these letter writers, would I want to be hauled into a courtroom, put under oath, and then have this sprung on me? Do you realize your letters are a matter of public record? Do you realize that these letters now can be out in a...
And I know your brief says that, but that's not all that he said. They took it as intimidation that he would publicize it if they didn't withdraw the letters. It's okay. Not simply say, do you realize what you're doing? Are you sure you understand the facts of this case?
Sure.
And I want you to understand the procedures that are going to follow. Those two people at least indicated they felt he was intimidating them or trying to scare them into withdrawing it. I know you don't think that's what happened. Can you explain to me why you all differ on this and what your position is?
Okay. Let's look at it this way. This threat is based on an assumption that the press release was not going to have what it had in it ultimately, unless they withdrew their letters. That, in other words, the press release was not a foregone conclusion. The record doesn't support that. Mr. Zahn had already drafted the press release. This case is over except for the sentence. He had already drafted the press release. He wasn't threatening anybody with the press release. It was going to say what it was going to say. And the reason why he'd already drafted the press release is this. This case was high profile, and there was great concern in the community.
Didn't he take out the names of the people, certain people, and left in other names?
Pardon?
In the press release, didn't it list only some names and not others?
It did, because you can't have your name in that press release unless you left your letter in.
Well, the letter's in regardless. Yeah. You can't withdraw it.
No, but that's not my point. What I'm saying is, Judge, is this. If the letter writer said, if I withdraw my letter, will my name be in a press release? Well, of course not. Because the press release, which had already been drafted, which was not a threat, it wasn't made up after the fact and said, look, I haven't drafted my press release yet. But what I'm thinking about is, if you don't withdraw the letter, I'm going to put your name in that press release. No. The press release had already been drafted, and all he's doing is answering truthfully to the letter writer.
Has this procedure ever been followed in other cases? Press releases, naming whoever has contacted the court or appeared as a witness for the defense?
I don't know. I can't. The record will speak for itself, Your Honor. I think there definitely were press releases. Mr. Zahn, it was on Facebook. He did press releases. But remember, in this case, and this goes back to the First Amendment argument, is this case is over. This is not a pending case where anybody's going to be prejudiced about what's in the press release unless you're a letter writer and you don't want the fact out there that you wrote a letter on behalf of a child sex abuser. We get that. So that's what Mr. Zahn was trying to get around. He was trying to give them the opportunity to avoid that, not as a threat, but this press release is going to be issued. Let's think about the press release, because I think it's very, very important here. Mr. Zahn was concerned that the people in the community who thought all these influential people could get this guy a good deal, that somehow because the bankers and other individuals who were very influential, and this was a banker, the defendant, is that if they went to bat for him, it would be quite persuasive with the judge. And he didn't want anybody to think that in Platte County, Missouri, that anybody got any special favor. So he made very, very sure that this was all laid out in a press release so they'd know how it went down. Now, the one component of the press release, which the OCDC characterizes as false, is not true. It is not false at all. The victim in this case, who threatened suicide because of what was going on, the victim in this case testified that when these influential members of the community stood up, and they did. They can parse it any they want. And remember, you don't just look at the letter. The fact is, why did they write a letter? They wanted leniency for this convicted child sex abuser, and they admitted that at the hearing. So the fact is, Mr. Zahn was looking at the victim, knowing her circumstance, wanting her to know that the community supported her. He put in there her exact testimony. She testified, Judge Stiff, if you look at the record, she testified that because these people stood up for him, I believe they're against me. She said that in open court.
And was that at the sentencing?
Pardon?
Was that at the sentencing?
I believe it is. The record will speak for itself.
So if what she said at the sentencing was in the press release, and the press release was not drafted before he talked to the letter writers?
Well, the record will speak for itself. I don't know that for a fact, but I do know that the record will show the press release was drafted. If you look at the record, it was.
That if they had disavowed their letters, their names would have been taken out of the press release that was already written?
It had to be, Judge, because it's factual. It's a true statement. You can't be in a press release as having a letter in front of the court if you don't. So my point is, and think about it, Judge Zahn was trying to tell the truth to these letter writers. If you look at the record, these letter writers were aghast. They go, we had no idea our letters were going to be matter of public record. In fact,
they were aghast. You're saying that they were told that their name would be in the press release unless they withdrew their letter.
No, Your Honor. Look, if you'll look at the record, you will see they didn't believe their letters were a matter of public record. Nobody.
I understand. That may be the case, but once that was done, then there were these further representations that if you don't want me to publicize this, you better withdraw the letter. And in fact, for those who did withdraw it, their names were taken out.
It's a matter of being factually true.
Is that behavior we want ongoing? My concern is you're saying this is perfectly everyday behavior, and you can do this to any witness. Could defense counsel do that to witnesses who might have testified on behalf of the victim?
Well, in fact, I mean, one of the comparisons we draw are about defense attorneys do exactly this all the time, except it's in courtroom under oath, and they take witnesses apart. But my point in this, Judge,
do you think defense counsel could have called proposed witnesses for the victim who might well have testified that the sanctions, the punishment should have been, as high as possible for all the many reasons you talk about? Could they have called and said, I'm going to issue a press release about this if you go ahead and testify?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose We can rewrite that press release here today. We could write it so that everybody's concerns would be addressed. But the point I'm trying to make here is, if the letter writer asked Mr. Zahn about a press release that he's already got authored because he believes it's under his duties as prosecuting attorney to keep the public advised and to support the victim in this case, and of course we've got amicus on that all over the place about prosecutors who
and
don't...
And that's why I asked if this was standard procedure or was this case special?
No, well, when you say standard procedure, you have to assume that there's other cases that look just like this. I think it's standard procedure. If he gets a case like this, he's going to do it every time because it's the truth. That press release speaks the truth. And there is not one case cited by the OCDC where a lawyer, after a case is over, spoke the truth about matters of public record, not privacy, not matters of privacy, speaks the truth that they've ever been disciplined, and that's in that Gentile case. The other thing about this intimidation and threatening, think about this. We cited to you Garrison versus Louisiana, where the United States Supreme Court, no less, said this: you cannot be threatened or intimidated with the truth. If somebody tells you the truth, that's a matter of public record. It's going to come out. You wrote a letter on behalf of a child sex abuser. You voluntarily did that. And the fact you did it, that's not a threat. That's the truth. So Gentile Garrison backs up everything Mr. Zahn did. So I don't understand this threat and intimidation with the truth. I don't get that. Now, we can talk about the so-called mischaracterization of the siding with the defendant over the victim. But here's the thing. If you look at a fair reading of what occurred in this case, every witness admitted the reason why they wrote the letter was because they wanted him to receive leniency. There's no dispute about that. So if you're a citizen of Platte County and you look at this and you say, well, all these people wrote these letters on behalf of him, so they're clearly supporting him. There's no question they're supporting him.
There's nothing in the language of that letter that asks for any leniency.
Well,
sets out facts regarding mitigating good conduct, as opposed to asking that there be any leniency.
So what was the purpose of the letter then?
Is to bring before the court facts that the statute allows to be considered.
But why would you want to bring that in front of the court? What do you want to be the end result? Leniency.
Have all the information before the court.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not going to argue with you, but in my point, the only reason why you write a letter to a judge and say, look at all the mitigating by its own definition means mitigate the sentence, which means reduce the sentence. So it may be, it's okay. I'm not saying it's not, Judge, but what I'm saying is this. It's a clear, reasonable inference that when people write letters seeking leniency, consideration, pointing out mitigating factors, that they clearly have said that we're wanting this consideration for this defendant. And the thing is, some of those letters even said they wanted him to come back to the community where the victim was after he served his time. They wanted him to come back, a convicted child sex offender.
Those aren't the people that the complaints are about.
Pardon?
Those aren't the people these complaints are about. The OCDC is looking into the two letters of people who did not say anything like that.
Well,
so those aren't before us.
And that's okay, but my point in all of this, Judge, is the fact that I think that's a fair statement. I think if this court were to try to parse out, that's not a fact, it's just pure opinion, it's not supported by the record. If I could, I need to get to one last issue here, if I might, unless you have an additional question. We all know that at the end of the day, when you violate a rule, you have to have notice of what that rule prohibits. This is not a gotcha set of rules. It's not a trap for the unwary. We want our attorneys in this state that every time they do something that they think might be questionable, they look at these rules and they automatically can tell with any reasonableness, this is what is prohibited. And clearly, Eric Zahn looked at these rules to determine what he was doing was well within those rules. He thought it was. Now, you all can say now, no, we think it ought to be interpreted this way. You shouldn't have done that. And that's fine. But notice isn't retroactive. You can't use your clarification here today of these rules and what's prohibited and say, well, he should have been on notice back here. The question is, and look at the cases he cites. the Gentile case, the Garrison case, the First Amendment. And by the way, for the OCDC to say this is conduct only and nothing about free speech, well, then why do they care what it says? It doesn't matter what the press release says. It's the fact that he filed a press release, the conduct. And here's the thing.
Counselor, you're 2 minutes over.
Okay.
Could you please wrap up?
Yeah, I will. And what I want to say is here, it's like Justice Gorsuch said in the recent Sessions case. It's all about notice. It's all about notice, because if we don't have notice, then we have no objective standard to charge others. We have none, because the notice is part of that. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I don't believe that Eric Zahn, based on the rules and the interpretation of the rules that we've seen previously, would have been on notice that he wasn't protected either by the rules themselves, by the First Amendment, or by the safe harbor provisions of 4-3.6. And if all of you, like me, have been watching the Governor Greitens matter and listening to defense attorneys in a pending case, I will add, not a complete, you've listened to defense attorneys and you listen to that, what you set down here as a standard, I wonder if I should have already filed a complaint. But the last thing.
Thank you. You're way over, and now you're injecting into things that aren't part of this
case.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you for your indulgence, Your Honor.
Well, you think that Mr. Zahn is doing these people a favor by subpoenaing them into his office 2 hours before the hearing on sentencing for the very purpose of threatening them to have them remove their letters. You think he was doing them a favor. Do you know what you did? You're right, Judge Stitt. The only letters he's charged with violating the rules on are Hague and the Nash's letter. I invite the court to take a look at those letters. They're found in the record. And Hague's letters at 191 to 193 in the appendix, and the Nash's letters at 199 to 201. They couldn't be any more benign than they are. And yet, this attorney threatened these people to get them to remove those letters and then issued a press release totally mischaracterizing what those letters say. The press release says that it breaks my heart to see pillars of the community, a county official, a bank president, appear to choose the side of a child molester over the child he repeatedly abused. The only people they opposed was this prosecutor, not the victim. There's nothing in there to suggest that they were opposing the victim. Judge Wolf, you're exactly right. These letters you might think of as ex parte communications, but they're from citizens. They're from non-lawyers. They didn't know what they were doing. They sent the letters to the judge. They could have moved to strike them. It's different than attaching an affidavit to a motion where I believe you might be arguing in an ex parte fashion. These were citizens. They're non-lawyers. And to hold them to
the... Sent it to both sides, too, though, you said?
Pardon me? And they were sent to both sides.
Time out.
Okay.
Weren't they sent to Judge Van Amberg, who then asked that they be placed in the file and shared with counsel?
I don't question that. You're probably right, Judge.
What's the judge to do if he receives something outside the record?
I think what Judge Van Amberg did is what you do.
Exactly. That doesn't mean it isn't an ex parte communication. It does mean that both sides were fairly given an opportunity to respond to the ex parte communication.
Correct. No, I absolutely agree with that. Thanks, Judge.
Address the notice issue, the notice question raised by Mr. Smith.
The notice as to why
they... what his client didn't have notice that the... What
okay,
his conduct
sure.
Might be
in their brief, they argue that 4.4 is overly vague. He doesn't know what conduct is going to subject him to discipline. The point is that rule specifically talks about three words: embarrass, delay, and burden. And I don't believe that any reasonable person, you don't even have to be a lawyer, to look at these facts and know that his sole purpose in sending that press release, first of all, and to meet with them, was to threaten them, okay? So there was 4.4A, because I'm going to issue this press release if you don't withdraw your letter. And then he dropped the hammer on them when they stood up to him and said, here comes the press release. You are supporting a child molester over the victim. Totally a false statement. It's not truthful. You know, they quote in their brief, if I can have about a minute, they quote in their brief from Gandhi, the truth never damages a cause that is just. A splendid quote. Has no application to this case, where he threatened, intimidated, and then lied in his press release. I think a more fitting reference and one closer to the home is that this case is being argued on May 1, Law Day. The day established 60 years ago today by proclamation of President Eisenhower, in which he said that the fundamental rights of individuals under the law is the heart of our nation and distinguishes our governmental system from the type of government that rules by might alone. Respondents' refusal to appreciate or acknowledge his misconduct shows he doesn't get it. He refuses to accept that fair-minded people might disagree with him. It's the same conduct and viewpoint that led to him being before the court today. What's also alarming to the informant is, based on a review of the amicus briefs, is that the prosecutors in this state, as well as the press association and their lawyers, failed to grasp the serious ethical violations committed in the case and the meaning of the dictate that prosecutors are to serve as ministers of justice. It therefore falls to this court to send a clear message to respondent, to Missouri's prosecutors, to the press, and to the citizens of Missouri that prosecutorial threats, intimidation, and false accusations will not be tolerated. That in the year 2018 and 50 years from now, in 2068, the case of In re Eric Zahn will stand for the rule of law in the state of Missouri, and that prosecutors who threaten, abuse, burden, and embarrass the citizens of the state of Missouri and thereby prejudice the administration of justice will be disciplined. Thank you.